It was a cheerless journey along white tiled corridors until the trolley pushed its way into the anaesthetics room. As I entered, the doors at the far end parted as a doctor came towards me bearing a loaded syringe. I had a chilling glimpse of the operating theatre beyond, with the lights beating on the long table and the masked surgeons waiting. The doctor pushed up my sleeve and swabbed my forearm with surgical spirit. I decided I'd seen enough and closed my eyes, but an exclamation from above me made me open them. "Good God, it's Jim Herriot!" I looked up at the man with the syringe. It was Teddy McQueen. He had been in my class at school, and I hadn't seen him since the day I left. My throat was dry after the injection, but I felt I had to say something. "Hello, Teddy," I croaked. His eyes were wide. "What the hell are you doing here?" "What the hell do you think?" I rasped crossly. "I'm going in there for an operation." "Oh, I know that. I am the anaesthetist here. But I remember you telling me at school that you were going to be a vet." "That's right, I am a vet."
"You are?"
His face was a picture of amazement.
"But what the devil is a vet doing in the RAF?
It was a good question.
"Nothing very much, Teddy,"
I replied. He began to laugh. Obviously he found the whole situation intriguing.
"Well, Jim, I can't get over this."
He leant over me and giggled uncontrollably.
"Imagine our meeting here after all these years. I think it's an absolute hoot."
His whole body began to shake and he had to dab away the tears from his eyes. Lying there on the blood wagon in my nightie and woolly socks, I didn't find it all that funny, and my numbed brain was searching for a withering riposte when a voice barked from the theatre.
"What's keeping you, McQueen? We can't wait all morning."
Teddy stopped laughing.
"Sorry, Jim,"
he said, "but your presence is requested within." He pushed the needle into my vein, and my last memory as I drifted away was of his lingering, amused smile. I spent 3 weeks at Creedon Hill, and towards the end of that time, those of us who were almost fully recovered were allowed out to visit the nearby town of Hereford. This was embarrassing because we were all clad in the regulation suit of hospital blue with white shirt and red tie, and it was obvious from the respectful glances we received that people thought we had been wounded in action. When a veteran of the First World War came up to me and asked, "Where did you get your packet, mate?" I stopped going altogether. I left the RAF hospital with a feeling of gratitude, particularly towards the hard-working, cheerful nurses. They gave us many a tongue-lashing for chattering after lights out, or smoking under the blankets, for messing up our beds, but all the time I marvelled at their dedication. I used to lie there and wonder what it was in a girl's character that made her go in for the arduous life of nursing. A concern for people's welfare? A natural, caring instinct? Whatever it was, I was sure a person was born with it. This tray is part of the personalities of some animals, and it was exemplified in Eric Abbott's sheepdog, Judy. I first met Judy when I was treating Eric's bullock for wooden tongue. The bullock was only a young one, and the farmer admitted ruefully that he had neglected it because it was almost a walking skeleton. "Damn," Eric grunted. "He's been running out with that bunch in the far fields, and I must have missed him. I never knew he got to this stage." When actinobacillosis affects the tongue, it should be treated right at the start, when the first symptoms of salivation and swelling beneath the jaw appear. Otherwise, the tongue becomes harder and harder, till finally it sticks out of the front of the mouth, as unyielding as the wood which gives the disease its ancient name. This skinny little creature had reached that state, so that he not only looked pathetic, but also slightly comic, as though he were making a derisive gesture at me. But with a tongue like that, he just couldn't eat, and was literally starving to death. He lay quietly as though he didn't care. "There's one thing, Eric," I said. "Giving him an intravenous injection won't be any problem. He hasn't the strength to resist." The great new treatment at that time was sodium iodide into the vein. Modern and spectacular. Before that, the farmers used to paint the tongue with tincture of iodine, a tedious procedure which sometimes worked and sometimes didn't. The sodium iodide was a magical improvement and showed results within a few days. I inserted the needle into the jugular and tipped up the bottle of clear fluid. 2 drams of the iodide I used to use in 8 ounces of distilled water, and it didn't take long to flow in. In fact, the bottle was nearly empty before I noticed Judy. I had been aware of a big dog sitting near me all the time, but as I neared the end of the injection, a black nose moved ever closer, till it was almost touching the needle. Then the nose moved along the rubber tube up to the bottle and back again, sniffing with the utmost concentration. When I removed the needle, the nose began a careful inspection of the injection site. Then a tongue appeared and began to lick the bullock's neck methodically. I squatted back on my heels and watched. This was something more than mere curiosity. Everything in the dog's attitude suggested intense interest and concern. "You know, Eric," I said, "I have the impression that this dog isn't just watching me, she's supervising the whole job." The farmer laughed. "You're right there. She's a funny old bitch, is Judy. Sort of a nurse. If there's anything amiss, she's on duty. You can't keep her away." Judy looked up quickly at the sound of her name. She was a handsome animal. Not the usual colour, but a variegated brindle, with waving lines of brown and grey mingling with the normal black and white of the farm collie. Maybe there was a cross somewhere, but the result was very attractive, and the effect was heightened by her bright-eyed, laughing-mouthed friendliness. I reached out and tickled the backs of her ears, and she wagged mightily. Not just her tail, but her entire rear end. "I suppose she's just good-natured." "Oh, aye, she is," the farmer said. "But it's not only that. It sounds daft, but I think Judy feels a sense of responsibility to all the stock on farm." I nodded. "I believe you. Anyway, let's get this beast onto his chest." We got down in the straw and with our hands under the backbone rolled the bullock till he was resting on his sternum. We balanced him there with straw bales on either side and then covered him with a horse rug. In that position he didn't look as moribund as before, but the emaciated head with the useless jutting tongue lolled feebly on his shoulders and the saliva drooled uncontrolled onto the straw. I wondered if I'd ever see him alive again. Judy, however, didn't appear to share my pessimism. After a thorough, sniffing examination of the rug and bales, she moved to the front, applied an encouraging tongue to the shaggy forehead, then stationed herself comfortably facing the bullock. Very like a night nurse keeping an eye on her patient. "Will she stay there?" I closed the half doors and took a last look inside. "Aye, nothing'll shift here till he's dead, or better," Eric replied. "She's in her element now." "Well, you never know. She may give him an interest in life, just sitting there. He certainly needs some help. You must keep him alive with milk or gruel till the injection starts to work. If he'll drink it, it'll do him most good, but otherwise you'll have to bottle it into him. But be careful, you can choke a beast that way."